You're listening to the Vocal Fry Podcast, your weekly dash of voice science, pedagogy, and pop culture. Coming to you from the fields of Trenzalore, where the doctor stands.
Vocal fam, we are here. Sarah.
It's us.
How you doing?
Henry started rolling over this week. Like, he's been rolling over from front to back, but that's not a big deal. Now he's rolling over from back to front, so he can roll both ways, which means he's more or less mobile. Yesterday, I spent 30 minutes just, like, grabbing him as he rolled across the room and, like, stopping him from running into walls and stuff, and which means we can't swaddle him, which means he rolls over in his sleep, which means that he woke himself up. Like, luckily not as much as we expected, but in the middle of the night, we hear, because he had rolled over and hit his head on the side of the crib.
Oh, yes.
And it wasn't even that he hurt himself. I think he just was startled and all of a sudden was awake and up, and it hit his head.
Yep.
And so we're like,
that is what they do.
Yep. So we're on day two of that. Like, it's only been two nights, but he did it less last night than the night before.
That's good.
So hopefully very quickly he will stop hitting his head against stuff.
Yeah, babies. Babies. I remember.
We put together a little pen to put him in, and he just rolls from one side of it to the other. It's very amusing.
Have you tried a bouncer yet? Does he have a bouncer?
He does not have a bouncer. I mean, he has a bouncer, not one that he stands in.
That's what I'm talking about.
But the type that he, like, lays in, you ought to see him go. Every day is leg day if you're Henry.
My son, when we got that bouncer, my daughter never really liked it because, again, that meant that she couldn't go anywhere. Charlie, he would spend hours in his bouncer, and it had obviously a series of toys you know, moving tactile things on it and, you know, noises and what have you. But he would eat breakfast most mornings. I'd change him. And, like, on a Saturday, you could put him in the bouncer and put on Mickey Mouse Clubhouse, and he would bounce for 2 hours.
I'm hoping – so there's a big consignment sale this weekend, and I'm planning on going to that and seeing if I can grab something like that, because I think he would love it, because he loves for you to hold him standing up, and he – pretends he can walk and all that stuff. But yeah, so not as much sleeping this week as we would hope, but, you know, he's real cute, so that's nice. And, you know, back at work after spring break.
Yep.
Always good, always good.
So we were going to talk today, Vocal Fam. Sarah had introduced the idea to me a couple weeks ago of doing an episode, since I just came off of a faculty search.
Sure.
That by whatever small margin of miracle was a positive one.
Yes.
Had a positive outcome, I mean.
Would you call it anything but positive?
Well, I guess I should say perhaps I would use the word successful.
That's a good word.
It was a successful outcome. Yeah. It was not a failed outcome.
Yeah.
Rather than putting a positive or negative qualifier on it at all. I mean, I think it's a positive thing, but... But, like, just...
You were selected.
I was selected, and I accepted.
Yeah, you went the entire way
through the process. Yeah. And, Vocal Fam, I have some perspective on this now from, you know, 16 years in higher ed, including my adjunct years, 19 years in higher ed. And so I have been on both sides of this process as... search committee chair. The only basic part of this process I've not been is dean. But also as interviewee, applicant, what have you. And I have some perspectives that I thought I would share. I'm going to start kind of dismal. I've been thinking about what I wanted to say.
Okay.
I'm going to start kind of bleak.
Okay.
Then I'm going to present some, I hope, useful advice.
Okay.
And then I'm going to round it out hopeful.
I do like ending on a positive
note. So just so Vocal Fam, just so you know, like that's going to be like our three-part process.
Don't get super depressed in the first like 10 minutes and be like, well, I'm done.
I'm out. So I'm going to take this from, I'm going to take this from bleak to process to hope.
I'm here for it.
Okay. So let's start out with the bad. 20 years ago, there used to be more open vacancies for tenure track or full-time applied music faculty positions.
Sure.
I'm not basing that on actual specific data that I have. I'm just basing that on, I think everyone would agree with
just
that.
Just looking at postings every
like
year.
Like if you go back to CMS postings, and for those of you who aren't familiar with searching for a job in higher ed, like mm-hmm. applied study or music in general, mm-hmm. Your best source of searching is always the College Music Society faculty vacancy, music vacancy list.
Okay.
That's definitely your go-to. Inside Higher Ed Jobs, there will be postings on there as well. You'll mm-hmm. see a lot of the same ones. And then Chronicle Vita. Chronicle.com, mm-hmm. like Chronicle Vita also has postings. But I think for music, the one where you're going to more or less unanimously find all of them that get posted in a year is going to be the music vacancy list from the College Music Society, which is a professional organization of musicians who are all in higher ed.
Yeah.
I've been a member for, you know, 16 years. I've never done a whole lot with CMS. I've presented at a couple of regional conferences, but it's never really been my...
It's not where you've...
I think a lot of instrumentalists. It's more instrumentalist-centric. I have some singer friends who have been heavily involved, but it's pianist and instrumental centric. Because, of course, like our choir director colleagues are, you know, huge into ACDA.
Sure. Yes.
Just like we're huge into Nats.
Yes.
Our opera colleagues, maybe NOA.
Yeah.
You know, obviously we all have our little sub-disciplines and what have you. But
absolutely.
But anyway, so that's where you can, that's where I would recommend searching for listings.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at listings from like 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and I think it's important in this conversation here at the beginning to have the perspective of cultural inflection points.
Okay.
So if you look at faculty listings through the 2007-2008 academic year, I would imagine that, generally speaking, there were more job postings, particularly for applied instrumental faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And 2008 I use as an inflection point because of the housing crisis.
Yeah.
Housing crash.
Sure.
So post that, universities all of a sudden started getting a little skittish about replacing tenure track lines.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, what 2008 also created
mm-hmm.
was that younger Gen Xers and older millennials
mm-hmm.
decided to not have any more children.
Yeah.
And so even if you were sort of in your key childbearing, rearing ages
yes.
of life, a lot of people made the life choice to not have a second kid or to not have a third kid or to not have any children at all solely because of financial reasons.
It do be expensive.
As you're finding out.
Yeah.
And I've known now for 14 years.
Well, even like before, like life's just expensive.
And it has certainly gotten so.
Yeah.
So anyway, that started a downturn in vacancies. So mm-hmm. like, but it created a cascade effect.
Mm-hmm.
Baby boomers who were still working didn't retire because their retirement funds also crashed.
Mm.
So they stayed on working longer
mm-hmm.
if they've even retired now.
Which is not necessarily the case,
16 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And we had people not having children.
Yeah.
that created a place that all of a sudden there started to be a much larger backlog of freshly minted DMAs who couldn't get jobs and of people like myself who were very fortunate that we got a tenure track job immediately before the crash.
Sure. And you're like, I'm just going to.
It created immobility for a lot of my generation.
Yeah.
They were not able to move up to a slightly bigger or better or what have you because no one was retiring. And all of a sudden, places started not replacing people.
Sure.
There was also a bit of a trend that I had noticed of people who were in tenure track jobs of the baby boomer generation retiring, moving back to their local place where they grew up and taking another job on a voice faculty.
Yeah.
Again, creating more backlog.
Of people who couldn't.
Yes.
Not even couldn't, like, but those are jobs that maybe traditionally would have gone to your newly minted DMAs.
So we started seeing this downward trend. Then people started seeing, by 2015, we started realizing, oh, nobody had babies.
Sure.
Now we have an enrollment cliff that's looming in 2025, 2026 that we already knew about, where there aren't going to be any college freshmen. Then the pandemic hits. Universities' budgets just go
wham.
And all of a sudden, we again see a downward trend in the number of tenure track lines that are being advertised or replaced. And now, come 2024, this was an interesting year to me. And I would even consider last year in this, because here's what we actually are finally starting to see happening. We are actually starting to see the turnover of the baby boomer generation.
They are retiring.
And retiring.
Yeah.
And I know plenty of 80-year-olds who are still working.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And particularly 70-plus-year-olds. Yeah. And I'm sure that I will be one of them one day. So, like, listen, you have my utmost respect and... Listen, I'm not saying anyone should retire until they need to need or want to retire.
Also, like, if you enjoy what you do, if you need to do what you do, it's kind of two branches.
Particularly
there.
If you're still engaged and effective.
Yeah.
Keep doing it. That's not what I'm saying.
Live your best life.
What I'm saying is we actually have started to see some of those people retire. At the same time, if they're retiring from places like this institution at Mississippi College, a liberal arts school, maybe it's got a small graduate program, what have you, as is happening with my position here, it is not being replaced. The adjunctification of higher ed is upon us. At the same time, I did see probably more voice tenure track jobs
this
year than I've seen in a while.
I was gonna say, like, just from, because I'm not a part of a lot of what you mentioned before, but like just from the Nats job posting emails that you get, I felt like there was so much more this year than any
than
year since I've been a member.
Yes, I would agree with that. There were definitely more this year. So I guess that's a hopeful thing.
We love some positives.
But I think in general, what we're going to continue to see in higher ed, we have already entered in what many people are calling the Great Retraction. We are going to see a lot of programs close that were small-ish.
Yeah.
I know a former graduate student colleague.
I was going to
say. Or not colleague, but former graduate student of ours. Her undergraduate program has closed. And I think what we're going to see in music... this is the prediction. What I think we're going to see is at those schools, they are not going to get rid of their ensembles. And so if you're out there and you're a choir director, a band director, maybe orchestra, if they already have orchestra, they are going, or rock band or jazz band or what have you, they are going to keep those activities and those faculty, particularly if they are already tenure track, if they are already tenured or tenure track or full time. Those people will remain, but people who teach applied music, I would venture to say the great majority of them will be adjuncted out at schools that are like smaller liberal arts colleges and whatnot. So maybe they won't get rid of their music program.
Yeah.
But I'm not convinced that those positions will be renewed as tenure track lines. I think it's going to start mostly with smaller liberal arts colleges and your regional satellite state university kind
of. Oh, yeah.
You know, sort of, you know, podunk you state.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just to make up a, so I don't name an actual institution.
Cool. Yeah.
That being said, as we said, we did see more postings this year.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about, I'm a singer and I'm thinking of, I'm a voice teacher and I would like to apply for one of these jobs. Okay?
Yeah.
I'm going to stay bleak for a second.
Okay.
Okay. One of the things that anybody considering this, generally speaking, needs to know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a philosophy that I've seen, that I've shared, that I've seen colleagues share. This is not like this is not proprietary. I didn't make this up. This is just an observation that I have seen throughout the years.
Mm-hmm.
You sing your way to an interview. You might teach your way to a job.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, in most cases, in order to get to an interview stage,
mm-hmm.
you need to be doing something interesting
mm-hmm.
and sing well. Now, yeah. I'm talking about just voice here, higher ed, not other music higher ed thing.
If you're trying I'm not talking about piano, you don't need to sing.
This is not a theory.
I mean, if you do, that's great.
Yeah, this is not a theory or musicology position or what have you. You in your profile, let's presume that you are not singing at the Met. Okay?
I think that's a valid.
That alone could maybe get you to a Zoom interview stage.
Okay.
Even if you're a Met chorister.
No, that's still very competitive, yeah.
Right. And I will say, still, a lot of the time, the people that I see interviewed are people who are having successful regional careers as mm-hmm. singers, etc. Because, again, you tend to typically sing your way to a job, sing your way to an interview, and then maybe teach your way to a job.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say doing something interesting, though, that mm-hmm. could be you've also been actually engaging in interesting work. That yeah. may not be. I'm thinking varied. I'm not just thinking. Don't assume that since we've done a lot of pedagogy and science talk on this.
It might not even be that.
I'm thinking of someone like Lily Guerrero, who has all her DEI work
yes.
and her singing.
Yes.
But like, you know, like that's what I mean by something interesting. You know, someone, you know, who is doing the kind of work that someone like Joshua or Theodora does.
Yes.
That might get them, you know, to that. Those are the kind of things that might get you to a Zoom round.
Sure.
You know, of an interview process. But let's talk about how we make ourselves look interesting in that.
Mm-hmm.
Four. Let's talk about four different things or five different things that are critical parts of this.
Okay.
The single most important part of this, and this is some backdoor how the sausage is made.
Okay.
Okay, like actually in the factory.
Okay.
It matters who your references are.
Oh, well.
That and it
sense.
Matters who your references know on the search committee.
Hmm.
That is what will get you an interview.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Well, I mean, it honestly does make sense because if they don't know the person saying all these lovely things about you, they're like, well, they could be a liar.
So as you're considering applying for jobs, really consider how connected mm-hmm. your references are.
Hmm. Yeah,
and I would say if you're considering DMA programs,
yeah.
consider how connected your mentors will be the field at large.
Yeah.
I cannot recommend that enough. Second thing.
Mm-hmm.
Get recordings of yourself in performance done way ahead of time.
Sure.
We say this about the Nats intern program application too, right?
Yes, yes.
And we even say this if you're out there as a young singer and you're applying to young artist programs.
Just get it done. Have the recordings.
You have got to have recordings that are polished, that are a reflection of your current singing.
Yes.
And be ready to send them out.
Don't wait until you're in the middle of applying and you're rushing trying to do whatever. Like, don't do that to yourself. As someone who has done that in the past, like, it is just so much more stress and honestly can end up keeping you from applying to something.
For sure.
Yeah, just
know that you're going to have performance recordings. And most of the time, I am seeing more and more job ads require that they be in the last 24 months.
I can't remember. There was something I was looking at recently, not a higher ed position, but that wanted your recordings to be, the number in my head is actually 6 months, within six, but it might not have been that.
I haven't seen any in higher ed that were that short.
Well, listen, I think this was for some sort of audition. It might've been back when I applied for SETC.
Sure.
I don't remember. There was a timestamp though of like these need to be recent-ish.
Yes. So that is something so that's my second recommendation.
Sure.
My third thing is you must be mentored in how to write a cover letter.
Mm.
And you need people to give you feedback on it.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to highlight. When you read a job ad, okay, but I want to relate the cover letter to the ad.
Mm-hmm.
The ad will tell you how to write your cover letter. I would, and this is going to sound harsh for a second. If you read an ad. And you cannot address the job qualifications in your cover letter. I'm not saying you have to, I want to be clear about this. You do not have to fit every one of them.
Okay.
But if you like read them and you don't fit.
Like any of them?
Any of them.
Might not be.
That is probably not the right fit for you to apply to.
Yeah. I don't think that's harsh. I think that's, save yourself some time. Because that's the other thing.
Because these things take time.
When you're applying to these, like, it's a lot of time and effort.
Yes.
And yeah, it's just a lot of time and effort. And, like, your time is valuable.
Generally speaking.
Also, when you're asking people to write, like, letters of rec, like, you're asking them to invest time. And if it's something where, like, yeah, anyway.
So ask yourself, can I at least address maybe 50% of these things?
Mm-hmm.
And then frame the cover letter
for
the job ad.
Oh, that makes sense.
You can actually tell AI to do this for you.
Oh, you know, I always forget about AI.
Like, you can feed it your info and the cover letter and have it write a cover draft
that
for you.
Then go,
I would certainly not use that as your cover letter.
Probably a bad idea. Having seen some AI writing.
But like one of the things, just a couple of recommendations in that regard. If you know that you're applying for an R1, research level very high, even probably most R2s. And it, like, particularly if it also says 40% teaching, 40% research, 20% service, which is the typical formulary. Okay. And yes, that is correct, Vocal Fam. The typical formulary at an R1 university for a music faculty is that teaching is 40% of what they're supposed to be doing.
Mm.
40% is their research.
That is.
And 20% is service to the profession and the department.
That's good. I mean, not that I'm like, oh my gosh, that's shocking, but like I would not have guessed those numbers, but that makes sense.
That is the industry standard.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, I have even seen positions where it's 60% research, 20% teaching, or 30% teaching and 10 or 20% service. Those are very more rare and more common in the sciences.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because I know Jamie talked about when he was at State, and I mean, he was a chemical engineering undergrad, and so many of those professors were, based on the descriptions he's given, like, the main part of their job was the research they did, and that is why the school hired them.
Correct. Yeah. Because those people usually also bring multi-million dollar grants.
Yes, no, that's exactly. I wasn't going to say that part out loud.
No, say it out loud.
Yeah, because he said some of them, like, they're teaching. He was like, they would walk in, and they just would, like, do equations
right
for an hour and then walk out. Right. And you were like, okay.
Just know that I remember my freshman, like, F equals MA for idiots class.
Yeah.
That, like, I had to take, like, a 3-credit science, like, sure, as a freshman. I remember the guy walking in, giving us the syllabus, and saying, tests are not during class time. They're Mondays at 5 p.m. These are the dates. Most of you will never be back in here. I'll be in my lab if you need me.
Amazing.
And he walked out.
Amazing. He just said, y'all aren't here for this.
He said, I'll be here to lecture, but don't ask any questions. I won't respond to you.
I love that. Good for him. Great. Anyway, for him. Great. What a way to live.
That guy did
life.
All kinds of studies in the reality of light.
Well,
had a big lab. Anyway, doesn't matter.
Well,
but okay, back at the
back
ranch. Most of the music positions, particularly voice, are 40-40-20.
That's more reasonable.
At a liberal arts school, if you are applying for a teaching position, yeah, and there is a vacancy,
yeah,
know that it is much more commonly 60-20-20.
That makes
with
sense.
With 60% being teaching, 20% being research, and 20% being service.
That makes sense.
That is what the percentages are here.
Okay.
And that at a true teaching college, mm-hmm, or university, that is more common.
Okay.
And so I bring those things up in the context of the cover letter to say that is how you need to build out your cover letter.
Yeah.
You need a little introduction.
Sure. Okay. I hate intros.
You know, basically stating who you are, okay, and how you heard about the job and if you learned about it from one of their colleagues.
Mention that, I assume.
And if you, you know, and your base qualifications of, you know, if you have a current job or if you, mm-hmm, have a DMA from what school, what have you.
Sure.
And then the next section needs to be about your research. Which can be performing, it can be other research. Again, I'm not telling you what makes you interesting.
Yeah, you gotta figure that out yourself.
You have to figure that out on your own.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, then obviously, and when you're fresh out, if I showed you my cover letter, your cover letter, if you're in the middle of a DMA, and my cover letter that
very
I just
different.
Wrote this year are gonna look vastly different.
That makes sense.
And that's fine.
Different points of your career.
You know, however, in a lot of ways, people who are fresh out actually have advantages right now because people don't want to pay mid-career folks.
Sure.
They don't want to hire at the associate level.
Yeah.
Like, I was very fortunate.
Yeah.
That the position that I was applying for, and part of the only reason I even considered applying for it, was that it was open rank. It was not assistant professor.
Yeah.
But most of the time, a lot of times right now, I'm seeing people have advantages of essentially being fresh out.
Sure.
Because you don't have the leverage of being like, well, I'm already making X.
Yeah. It's just, please hire me.
It's just, please hire me. And they know that their first offer within another $2,000 you're liable to say yes to.
Yeah.
But anyway, the cover letter matters.
Yeah.
Your recordings matter. Your references matter in that reverse order. References, recordings, cover letter.
Mm.
The other thing, well, and within that, being interesting matters.
Yeah.
Okay? The other thing that I would then tack on, in some cases, they will want to see teaching videos.
Mm.
It's more rare,
mm-hmm,
particularly in intro-level positions.
Okay.
there are several reasons for that, I think, because again, I think generally speaking, we as singers and singing teachers think we're more adept at evaluating singing than voice teaching.
Yeah, I buy that.
Most people don't sit around evaluating as much voice teaching as I do.
As you do,
If you'd like to view singing teaching, there are about, I don't know, 7-8 lessons now on my YouTube channel, Nicholas Perna, Tenor and Teacher, including one with Sarah.
Oh, yeah.
But one of the things I'd highly recommend, and I think it was Ian Howell who recommended this to me, I don't remember now. Forgive me if that's correct or wrong. But what I did was, rather than making like short excerpts of me doing a thing, I put time codes, which if you put a time code in a YouTube comment,
it can take
it
you
links
to it,
it right?
Which is so nice.
And so I put, every time I changed an exercise,
you just put the stamp.
I put a time stamp and I write what I was trying to accomplish in that exercise.
Make it easy for whoever's looking at your stuff.
Correct.
Show them what you want to show them.
Correct. So if you'd like to see examples of that, there's like 7-ish examples of that on my YouTube. I actually have one that I just recorded with my daughter of me teaching a child that it's like a 7.5-minute long clip.
That.
I'm going to try to get that uploaded, but I want to put what I was trying to do with each exercise and stuff. Anyway, so if you'd like to see examples of that.
Yeah.
And by the way, Vocal Fam, if we know each other, or even if we don't know each other that well, and you really want to see a cover letter, if you want to email me, vocalfryperna@gmail.com, I'm more than happy to send you a PDF of, you know, what my cover letter looked like this year. So anyway, then you have to be ready for the Zoom round. Let's say that you get a bite.
Yeah, it happens. Okay? Woohoo!
You get a bite. You have to be ready for the Zoom round.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, most of these that I have observed or been a part of, you have to be ready for the same questions.
Oh.
Why do you want to work at our school?
Okay, valid.
There's going to be a DEI question.
That totally makes sense as well.
There's going to be a recruitment question.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how are you going to recruit?
Makes sense.
And then there might be some other questions generally about voice stuff.
Sure, making sure you're not
your pedagogy, your teaching.
Sure.
Perhaps. I would also be ready, particularly if it's an assistant professor intro position, for the question, how do you plan to earn tenure? Like, what activities?
Don't be caught off guard.
What reason? Don't be caught off. So those are the ones that I would say do not be caught off guard by that set of questions.
That makes sense.
A DEI question, a recruitment question, a why do you want to work here?
Funny thing on the why do you want to work here? We back when they were bringing people on campus for the position you currently are here for, one of the candidates. They had him in, and they had a Q&A session with the students.
I remember.
Where we got to ask questions, and someone who's on this podcast right now, asked one of the candidates, well, why are you interested in coming here? And that candidate said, well, I guess I could ask you the same thing. Why are you here? And wouldn't answer the question.
Wow.
That person doesn't work here.
Great.
Right? I remember being very salty about that.
Wow. That's a thing.
I was like, what a bold thing. Like, I was like, excuse me, you're here interviewing for this. Like,
wow, that's a, okay.
What a choice. Anyway,
so
funny.
So anyway,
maybe don't answer like that.
Then let's say that you get past a Zoom round and you actually get invited to campus.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I have one piece of advice that I forgot.
Okay.
With your references.
Mm-hmm.
Always ask them to be a reference before you list them.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
And if you know whether or not you're going to need letters or not, give them ample prep time.
Sure.
Okay, so then let's say you get to campus.
Okay.
You're in most voice cases, you're going to need a 25-minute long recital.
Okay.
So just have it ready.
Be ready.
You're going to teach two styles of singing, two singers in a master class.
Oh, okay. Yep.
And you're probably going to give some kind of lecture.
That all makes sense.
You will also, over the course of the day that you're on campus, probably have a session with the committee that will be brutal.
Okay.
Where they will grill you about your life.
Makes sense.
Probably grill you about what you did in the master class.
That also makes sense.
And rehash some of the same questions that they ask you in the Zoom round because they forgot your answers.
Well.
Anyway, I know I've been guilty of that. On search committees, I mean.
Sure.
You will also usually have an interview with a department chair and a dean.
That makes sense.
You also may, in some instances, even have an interview like I did with this last one with a DEI committee.
Wow, okay.
That was part of my day.
Yeah.
Those are the typical... Every institution, of course, has their own little...
things they do.
Now, there's one other thing, two technically, that I want to alert you to that are part of the interview. Three, actually.
Okay.
The moment that you get off the plane,
mm-hmm.
the interview has begun.
Oh, just so every moment.
Your car ride... from and to the airport is part of the interview.
Makes sense.
Lunch
is part of
is a crucial part of the interview.
That makes sense. They want to know if you do you fit into the culture.
And dinner is one of the most important
parts
of the interview.
So no pressure. You just have to be on.
I observed in my years, I have a long and storied history with faculty searches because from my freshman year of college on, I was a guinea pig for two faculty searches.
Really?
My freshman year of college.
That's wild.
And I observed innumerable
sure.
faculty searches through my undergrad, master's, and DMA. I observed faculty searches at all levels before I was on faculty searches as a faculty and or applying for other jobs.
Yeah.
I observed one, and I all I'll say is that I was, it was in my schooling. I was a student, okay? And let's say I was not an undergraduate.
Yeah.
I was a graduate student, and my mentor... and we observed a recital and a master class, and I was convinced that this individual was going to get a job offer.
Wow. Okay.
They went for Mexican.
Okay.
As a committee, and by 8 o'clock the next morning, that individual had lost the job.
Wow.
Like, my mentor was convinced that that was the after the work.
Yeah.
Was in love. After dinner,
not so much.
The offer was gone.
Wow.
Gone.
So, it matters.
So, know that if you are fortunate enough to make it that far, that it matters. You also may have the great fortune, and I think this matters more and more,
okay,
to have a time to meet with students with none of the committee present, as we did. Here.
Yeah, that,
and
that,
as
always,
I did, I got a chance to meet with some doctoral students in Boulder by myself.
That's awesome.
It was my favorite part of the day.
Yeah.
That's no offense to anything else that happened that day.
But
it was just...
great part. Yep.
I love mentoring students.
Yeah.
As you know.
What? Yeah.
So it meant a lot.
Yeah.
Anyway... be prepared for that as well. Like, if you know, and I'm going to relate my hopefulness here at the end to that session.
Okay.
I was asked pretty bluntly, and I loved it.
Okay.
In that session, what the value of a DMA was.
Sure.
You know, because 25 years ago, and 20 years ago, and even when I started teaching doctoral students, my answer was generally, you should not do a DMA unless you absolutely know you want a job in higher ed.
Yep.
And I think my thinking has evolved.
Okay.
I was honest with those graduate students,
mm-hmm.
and I said, I can't give you an honest answer. I can't give you a deliberately positive answer
mm-hmm.
because of the state of the job market
mm-hmm.
and the enrollment cliff.
Mm-hmm.
But I had said something earlier in the day that I related this back to.
Okay.
When I'm teaching pedagogy,
mm-hmm.
I am trying to teach you skills that make you able to earn an income.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that you should do a DMA or any degree
mm-hmm.
is that you are curious about something you don't yet understand or know.
Mm-hmm.
Whether about your own singing, whether about teaching singing, and have something that you are curious about and want to know more about.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, the bad reason to now do a DMA
would be just because
that I want a job in higher ed.
Yeah.
You don't have a guarantee of a job in higher ed.
No.
But remember I keep saying about the interesting part?
Yes.
If you are genuinely curious about something,
mm-hmm.
you will likely do the kind of work, and hopefully if you have a mentor willing to engage with you, I know I am, in the kind of work that curiosity needs and requires,
mm-hmm.
you will leave your DMA interesting.
Yeah.
You will also hopefully okay. leave with the ability to teach singing well and make money.
Those are good too.
Whether or not, to me, that is in higher education, music
mm-hmm.
is kind of irrelevant.
Okay.
And I know that I'm presenting in a lot of ways like this idealized world of why you should pursue a course of study.
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah.
At the same time, if you're just in a holding pattern of staying in school, I can't recommend that you stay.
Just stay in school to put off.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, what do you honestly want to know? And listen, I don't think that has to be anything to do with science.
Mm-hmm.
It could be.
It could be.
It could be to do with something with a DEI initiative.
Yeah.
It could be to do with something of advocacy. It could be something to do with teaching a population of student age range that we don't have enough written on.
Yeah, yeah.
It could be, I'm not limiting what it could be. It could be about learning more about African diaspora folk singing.
Yeah.
And you're going to go do a residency, you know, yes. in Nigeria or something. I mean.
But just, what do you want to know?
But what do you want to know?
Yeah.
Like, and then you will likely do the work to leave interesting. And even if you do want a job in higher ed, you'll be more employable.
Yeah, that makes sense. When it sounds like, too, like, if you've got those questions in that drive, like, you're almost going to do some of the work that you would do in a DMA, like, you're going to do it regardless. You're just going to have more tools and help.
Exactly.
Without, so.
And if you're in a DMA program or you're in a master's program out there and you're like, I think I want to do a DMA or like, I think I want to do a thing and you're mm-hmm. listening to us and you want to ask some interesting questions, come on.
Do it.
Let's go. Let's go.
Do it.
I'm not trying to dissuade you.
No, that did it more positively.
Breakfast.
Greek yogurt and the little proteiny bar things. I needed more protein than I was already getting, so we've thrown some Greek yogurt back in there.
Nice.
Yeah, good times.
In case you're wondering, Vocal Fam, I have actually now officially been named as executive director of Opera Mississippi, no longer interim. So
That's
an exciting thing.
Y'all should see Dune Part 2 on a different
apparently
day.
You should also see Dune
it's really
Part
good. If you've
two.
Seen it and you wanted to talk with somebody, hit me up. This is the one thing I've done recently, guys.
And whereas my only thing that I've done has been able to watch and finish the season of Halo, which is epic. It is so great. But if you have never played the game, you will hate it.
Ah, well, Dune Part 2, you should just see.
Right.
It's good.
The other thing, just to give you an example, I mentioned this, I think, last week. I forgot how much I adore Community.
Oh my gosh.
The writing. By the time he hit the end of season one, like,
it just finds it's
a little bit egregious with Joel McHale's character, like,
well,
making out with every female on the show,
yes,
practically, which is a bit much. And I noticed that a lot more this time, this rewatch. I was like, oh, this is kind of.
This is a lot.
This is a lot. But outside, and of course, you know, Chevy Chase's character.
Yeah.
But
wild.
But oh man, Donald Glover and
so
and
good.
Danny Pudi just firing on all cylinders.
Is in the new season in the remake of Avatar The Last Airbender.
Who?
Pudi.
Danny Pudi?
Yeah.
Nice.
Every time we say, I'm like, Abed, what are you doing here?
Nice.
Abed.
He's hilarious. Anyway. All right, Vocal Fam, we're out.
Yeah.
Peace.
Bye.